With me on the phone is Dr. David Meltzer, professor of prehistory at Southern Methodist University and author of the book First Peoples in a New World, Colonizing Ice Age America, published by the University of California Press. David, thanks for speaking with me today.
Happy to be here, Alan.
Dust to dust, flesh and bone, even teeth eventually go the way of all things. What sort of evidence do you look for, and how do you know where to look when you're looking for the first Americans?
Well, we look all over, and in fact, one of the things that we often do is count on folks whose eyes are on the ground more of the year than ours are. Unfortunately, I have a day job. I'm a professor here at SMU in Dallas, and as a result, 9 months out of the year, I'm in a classroom yearning to be outside. But when I do get out in the summer, one of the things that we often do is we'll survey landscapes, we'll talk to ranchers and farmers who may have collections that they've made over the years or that granddad picked up out on the ranch somewhere, and we'll look at the kinds of things that have come off the ground, and oftentimes what we seek are particular artifacts that tell us something about time. A lot of artifacts, as you know, are stylistic. That is to say, they convey a particular fashion, if you will, of the group who made them, and those things can often be diagnostic of a particular time period. And so we're looking for certain kinds of things that will give us a clue that people had been in that place a very long time ago. And then from there, there's actually a fair number of things that come into play. We might do some geological prospecting. We might do some remote sensing. We might do some test excavations. There's a variety of things that will ultimately get us settled onto a particular site.
So stylistically, in the Four Corners area, for instance, and this is much more recent, there are actually groups of people who are named for the styles of the baskets that they make.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the archaeological cultures that I deal with, the very, very ancient ones, are known by the particular sites in which they were first found because the people who made them, their descendants over the thousands and thousands of years, have multiplied and spread, and it's very often difficult to sort of link them with a particular tribe, so we link them with those distinctive kinds of styles.
And the styles that you would find, baskets would not last, would not survive the tens of thousands of years, but things made of stone would.
And in fact, most of what we deal with on the time periods that we're investigating are primarily stone artifacts. We occasionally get bits of bone. But it's surprising. Once in a while, if all the conditions are right, you can actually find preserved what we refer to as perishable artifacts, as, for example, baskets and bits like that that otherwise and regularly simply don't survive the passage of time.
For quite a while, well into the 20th century, it was very controversial as far as how far back the record, the history of the Native Americans went. People said, well, they must have come here well after the Ice Age. Where did that controversy come from? Why was it so intense?
European wannabes is probably the best way to start that answer, and that is that in the old world, in Europe, in France, in Germany, in England, in the 19th century, it was discovered that human prehistory reached back hundreds of thousands and possibly even millions of years, and American archaeologists who were anxious to prove for lack of a better term, nationalistic reasons, that the New World was just as old as the Old World went searching for evidence. And in their enthusiasm and exuberance to discover evidence of truly ancient people here on this hemisphere, on this continent, they got a little carried away, and they started bringing forth evidence that really wasn't terribly compelling or convincing. And what happened was that people called them on it, and they said, well, look, your evidence just doesn't hold up. The geological record doesn't demonstrate or affirm that your material is as old as you think it is.
How old was that?
Well, they were thinking it was tens and possibly hundreds of thousands of years old. And so in the absence of firm geological evidence to demonstrate that that was the case, it all sort of dissolved into this fairly bitter dispute that literally lasted decades as people fought back and forth as to whether something truly was old or not.
What sort of geologic evidence do you look for? How can you say that this point, let's say, it's made out of a rock that's a million years old, how can you say that it was manufactured at a certain time?
Good question. Let's actually set a little bit of the historical context, and then I'll sort of work my way into the answer. This controversy really began in pre-radiocarbon days. That is to say, before archaeologists or scientists had an ability to actually determine the age of not necessarily the rock itself, but the charcoal that might have been used at a campfire, or the bones of an animal that might have been killed. And so in those days, the way you determined the antiquity of an artifact was with the deposits in which it was found. And if the deposits in which it was found were, for example, glacial in age, that is to say, from the Ice Age, then you could say, okay, well, that meant people were here in the Ice Age. On the other hand, if it wasn't entirely clear that that artifact had been laid down at the same time as those Ice Age sediments or gravels, then that opened the room for controversy. And in fact, that often was the case because artifacts can move around in the ground. Things can fall into cracks and they can end up in older deposits. And so the age of the deposit may not be the same age as the artifact.
And normally you use stratigraphy. So you say the lower the level you find this thing, the older it is. But as you say, it could be a crack that cuts across.
Absolutely. Now what happened was this controversy actually got resolved, or at least the first cycle of it, got resolved in 1927 prior to the advent of radiocarbon dating. And the way it was solved was at a site in northeastern New Mexico, a place called Folsom, a stone artifact, a stone spear point, was found lodged between the ribs of a now extinct species of bison, buffalo. And because it was known that that bison had gone extinct at the end of the Ice Age, then it became possible to say, well, that stone artifact, that stone spear point, stuck him between those ribs, a human must have shot that. The odds are against you having a stone spear point somehow falling down a crack and ending up perfectly placed in between a pair of bison ribs, right?
Sure.
And so that confirmed the case.
How far back is Folsom?
Well, as a matter of fact, we did a fair amount of work at the Folsom site in the late 90s and reanalyzed much of the material that had been dug in the 1920s, as well as some of our own work, our own excavations there in the 1990s. And we finally did pin down the age of that site. I can tell you that it's 10,490 years old, plus or minus 20 years.
And that was a breakthrough. That showed that, indeed, people were living here 10,000 years ago. And that was when Ice Age conditions were sort of considered the end of the Ice Age, but that's still a long time ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what happened after Folsom, and this is it's kind of an interesting sort of lesson about human curiosity, is that having demonstrated at the Folsom site that people had been in the New World since at least about 10,000 or so years ago, the next cycle began. People began to ask, well, okay, 10,000, but does that necessarily mean we need to stop here? Could there be still earlier evidence of people in the New World, which prompted sort of the next round of controversy as people sought time and again to find evidence of a still earlier presence in the New World?
And that really opens up the whole question of, well, to begin with, where did these people come from?
All signs point to Asia. We have now... some of this is evidence that's just been developed in the last 10 or 15 years. We have evidence from genetics, linguistics, skeletal biology, and certainly archaeology that all suggest that ancestral Native American peoples came out of Asia. They came across what's now the Bering Strait, but was at the time probably dry land, the Bering Land Bridge.
So this is the Ice Age. There are glaciers on the land covering a good part of Canada, northern United States, and that sucked up water. That's water that's no longer in the ocean. So the sea level has dropped by hundreds and hundreds of feet.
Absolutely. In fact, the estimates now are that sea levels fell about 120 meters plus or minus 10. So putting that into feet, we're talking 360, 370 feet down. What that does is expose all the continental shelf that connects up and that is now drowned between Siberia and Alaska.
And the Bering Strait, which is water that connects the Pacific with the Arctic Ocean, it's dry land, and we can presume that it was sort of steppe, it was grassland.
Absolutely. We have no evidence that it was glaciated. We know it was fairly cold, fairly dry. It was probably a great grazing ground for animals like woolly mammoth and giant bison. We know these animals are out there on the landscape. So it would have been a place that humans could have inhabited. And in fact, we should probably add that going from Siberia to Alaska probably would not have been something that people would have realized. That is to say, they wouldn't have known that they were going from the old world to the new. one should not think of the Bering Land Bridge as a sort of narrow rope ladder across some Amazon river. This is actually something that's about 1,000 miles wide. So you probably had no sense that you were on a bridge.
The horizon from one side to the other would still be dry land.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I do want to point out that you mentioned them hunting the giant bison, which is different from the species we have now. It's an extinct species that was quite a bit larger than the buffalo we see today.
Absolutely. Estimates range from anywhere from about 10 to 20% larger, so substantially heftier critters, which makes one admire all the more folks who would take a sharp stone, mount it on a stick, and go after one of these critters.
That also ties into how they were able to support themselves. In other words, where were they getting their food, their energy?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. These were hunting and gathering people. They were highly mobile people as well. So we're not talking about farmers who are planting their own food and staying in one place year-round. These are folks who are living off the land, doing so very effectively, very efficiently. I mean, we know these populations not only survived, they thrived when they came to the New World because they were able to very quickly adapt to a new landscape. They pretty quickly figured out what kinds of things would feed them, what kinds of things would cure them. They also probably pretty quickly figured out what kinds of things would make them sick or what kinds of things would kill them. These folks were extraordinary botanists and geologists and probably zoologists as well, who would learn the behavior of the animals that were their prey, who would learn something about the distribution of the plants that were gathered by them.
So these people came from Siberia into Alaska and then into the rest of North America. How far back can we push it that they were living in North America?
The $65,000 question. It's hard to say, and it's hard to say for a couple of reasons. First and most obviously, the oldest site that we have is not necessarily going to be the oldest site that there is. That is to say, the site that we happen to find that's very old just happens to be very old. It doesn't mean that's the very first time somebody set foot on this continent. At the moment, we've got some sites that are upwards of about 12,000 or more years old. The genetic evidence, and here's the sort of wrinkle in the answer here, there is genetic evidence that we now have that would suggest that early ancestral Native American groups split off from their Asian brethren around 18,000 years ago.
Before I ask you how geneticists can figure that out, let me just tell our audience that we're listening to Dr. David Meltzer. He's the author of First Peoples in the New World. How can geneticists figure out that it's been that long since they split apart by looking at people's genes?
It's fascinating stuff. The last 20 years of genetics has been just revolutionary for any number of reasons, you know, the obvious sort of medicinal ones and that kind of thing, but also in terms of population history, because what's been discovered and what's now fairly well known is that there are corners of the human genome in which information is passed on down through a single parent. That is to say, from father to son to son to son to son, down the Y chromosome, and then from mother to child to child to child to child, but only down through the female line in the mitochondrial DNA. Now, here's the cool thing. As genetic material gets passed down through the generations, there are mutations. It's just part of the nature of heredity, right? Most mutations are not necessarily deleterious. They're not going to kill you. They're just little switches in the DNA. Well, if you've got a population that is living, say, in Asia 18,000 years ago, and some of them decide, you know what, we're just going to head off toward the rising sun. We're going to go east. And they go away. A few months pass. A few years pass. They don't come back. Turns out they've discovered a new world. Well, over time, they are no longer part of the same gene pool. That is to say, they're no longer part of the same population that's living there in Asia. And yet, they share some of those same genetic traits. And these are neutral traits. These have nothing to do with whether you're, you're short or tall or good looking or smart or anything like that. These are just sort of little blips in your genome.
So they're not even seen by selection processes.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're
random. For the most part, these are invisible to natural selection and to us. Okay, so the group that went off to America carries some of those ancestral markers, but they're developing their own. And so what happens over time is that you have this increasing genetic distance, in the sense that they started out with the same sort of genetic makeup, and then they've evolved these neutral traits, you know, these just little tiny switches that don't make any difference whatsoever, but they're there, right? And so they've accumulated over time. You can use the genetic distance between two populations, say a Native American group and a Native Northeast Asian group, and use that as a measure of time. Because we know, based on a whole bunch of studies, what the mutation rate is. So if you know what the mutation rate is, and you know how far apart two populations are, it's simply a question of math to say, given X number of changes in the molecule occurring at a certain rate, and we've got this much difference between these two groups, then therefore that would suggest that at least 18,000 years separate these populations. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's a simplified explanation.
And just to make sure folks understand mutation rate, that means you expect one mutation every 1,000 years or something like that. So if you find five mutations, it means those two populations have been apart for 5,000 years.
That's the principle, absolutely. The details vary, as they always do, but that's exactly right. That's the principle.
So looking at genetics, how long has it been since the Native Americans have seen their relatives, their cousins, in Siberia?
Well, if they got on a plane and went from Fairbanks to Novosibirsk, they probably could have seen them recently.
Unfair.
sorry about that. By the genetic clocks, and mind you, there's multiple clocks. Some of them work on the mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down the maternal line. Some of them work on the Y chromosome changes, which are passed down the paternal line. But generally, they're all converging on an estimate of around 18,000 years ago, to say that sometime around 18,000 years ago, modern Native American groups, and we probably want to exclude from that calculation Eskimo Aleut populations, because they appear to be a more recent arrival in the far north, in the Arctic. But most modern Native American groups, geneticists would suggest, split off from their Asian brethren, cousins, 18,000 or so years ago.
18,000 years ago was pretty much the height of the Ice Age. There were glaciers coming in from Canada. There was the West Coast ice that met that one. They met in Canada, essentially Alaska. It would have been very difficult to cross over that ice. Even the animals would not be crossing the ice. What happened? How did they make it at that time, if the dating is right, if the timing is right, how did they get from Siberia over the land bridge, no problem there, but then how did they get to the lower 48?
Fair question. Absolutely. It was probably a two-step process. As you say, getting from Siberia to Alaska, piece of cake, you just walk. Getting from Alaska down to the lower 48, you were probably not able to do it for several thousand years if you first arrived in Alaska at 18,000, because you would have been basically bottled up there. All routes south were pretty much blocked by these massive ice sheets. Around 13,500 years ago, the outer coast, the Pacific coast of North America, began to become ice-free. And so the suspicion at the moment, given that we have sites that are around 12,000 to 12,500 years old, the suspicion at the moment is that the first groups, once that coast became ice-free, skirted down the coast.
In boats or walking?
Well, we don't know. Boats certainly don't preserve in the archaeological record. It's just not entirely clear whether they were able to just make their way on foot down the coast or whether they had skin boats or something along those lines. We just don't know.
Once they got down to the lower 48, they almost jogged across the continent. The sites you find are so close together in time that it seems almost mysterious that they would have just kept on moving.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things in response to that question. One thing is that if you lock into an ecological niche, and let me just put that in sort of more common terms, if you figured out how an environment works, if you figured out how to get resources out of a particular setting, like a coast, if you're fully adapted to a coast, it's actually relatively easy to move quickly through that environment.
Down the coast, in other words.
Down the coast, exactly right. If you decide, well, you know what, I really want to cross the Olympic Mountains and go see Seattle, even, of course, you don't actually know that Seattle's there, but you want to just, head inland, that's complicated. That slows you down.
And that's because you're not going to be fishing very much, at least not ocean fishing.
Right.
In the mountains.
Right, absolutely. You've got to figure out, okay, there's this four-legged thing that looks pretty tasty. It's a deer. I haven't seen a deer before. I've been busy going after fish and collecting shellfish in tide pools. And how do I go after this four-legged thing? And what do I use to capture it? And what is it, tell me, I've got to figure out its behavior, so I've got to be able to predict what it's going to do if I try and sneak up from downwind and so on and so forth. So,
not to mention recipes.
always. So these kinds of things slow you down. Now, what's emerging at the moment is that the peopling of the Americas may not be, and probably was not, a one-shot deal. It may well be that we had an early group that moved down the coast, but then a group that came probably 1,000 or so years later that actually came down through the interior. The Clovis people, as they're known archaeologically based on a site where they were first found in New Mexico, these folks moved awfully fast as well, and they were adapted to terrestrial environments. And so it may well be that these are sort of unrelated populations, but not completely unrelated. They're all coming from an Asian ancestral population. But it might represent a couple of migratory pulses that sort of headed east and headed off to the New World.
And there's something about the Clovis toolkit, in other words, the technology that they used, that makes their campsites, perhaps even village sites, very identifiable, very recognizable. Perhaps you could describe the Clovis point.
Sure. Clovis points were spear points. They tend to be about 2 to 3 inches long, about an inch or so wide, and they have a very distinctive feature on them. Chipped off of each face of the spear point is a flute or groove. Picture, if you will, a World War I bayonet, with that groove down the middle of it. Back in World War I, those grooves were used for, I guess, bloodletting. We suspect that the grooves or flutes on Clovis points were not necessarily for the purpose of goring something and having it bleed horribly, but in fact were part of the hafting, that is to say, the manner in which that projectile point or spear point was attached to the spear. By having that groove in there, you could lay bits of bone or wood and get a nice tight seal, wrap it up, bind it from the stone to the spear, and that groove would sort of seat the binding material that we're using. And that makes them pretty easily identifiable.
Now, you find Clovis points pretty much all over the lower 48, including they must have crossed, for instance, the Mississippi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Every time there's a big flood on the Mississippi, I look at those aerial shots, and the river is, 2, 3, 4 miles wide, and I think to myself, imagine 11,000, 10,000 years ago, at a time when the great glaciers, the great ice sheets of the far north were still draining, and they were draining down the Mississippi. So the Mississippi must have been huge in those days. But that gets back to the question you had asked earlier about boats. Clearly, at some point, somebody fashioned a boat because they had to get from the western half of the continent to the eastern half of the continent. So those things must have been available, or at least somebody had figured it out by the time they got to the western banks of the Mississippi.
Now, this planet has heard at least 6,000 different languages. And of those, a good 1,000 of them were American languages. What does language tell you? When we especially know, we're talking about right now, listening to people talk, how can we then work back to who came over, when they came over?
That's a little more complicated. Languages change, certainly, and languages evolve. And so you can see connections. You can see relationships in words, in grammatical structures, in sound between different groups if they're relatively closely related to one another. So, for example, all the Eskimo Aleut languages are quite similar, to the point where Some of them are dialects as opposed to entirely separate languages. As time goes on, differences in languages become more and more pronounced. And so it becomes more and more difficult to determine whether two languages are related to one another, and if they are related, how far they've been separated from one another. And this gets into an extraordinarily controversial area among linguists as to just how far back you can push or identify linguistic similarities or differences and determine whether groups who are speaking separate languages were part of the same language community thousands or perhaps tens of thousands, and some linguists will even tell you they can go back hundreds of thousands of years based on words or at least elements of words that they see spoken today.
I'm speaking with Dr. David Meltzer. He's the author of First Peoples in a New World, published by University of California Press. Dave, I realize linguistics is not your bailiwick, but you've obviously studied it, and you're looking at what the linguists are saying. What sort of things are they looking for? While you're looking for hard physical evidence, they're listening to words. What are they looking for?
They look for cognates, because cognates will often tell you something about whether two languages are related to one another.
Cognates are words that sound very, very similar, which is what makes it possible for some of us who are not real good at languages to actually learn French or Spanish, because we do share a number of words.
Actually, and that's a good example, because English is not actually part of the Romance languages of French and Spanish and Italian. It's Germanic. But there's a lot of cognates between English and French, largely because of the Norman conquest. And this is a good example of how complicated things can be, because languages evolve on their own. But you can also have contact between different language groups, which can sort of complicate the case, because suddenly now you've got cognates, not because they're distantly related and they share an ancestor. You've got cognates because these folks came over and introduced a word. And, well, look at languages today. Look at the kinds of words that are global, regardless of what the native language is. You know, words like supersonic or fax or internet, right? I mean,
sure.
These are in all languages, and that doesn't mean that we're all sort of related. It means that we've all borrowed the same terms.
Now we're getting into, we see the language evolving. Cultures evolve. Language is part of culture. We're sort of seeing these Paleo-Indians, the first Americans, evolving into the tribes that we're much more familiar with. Can you go anywhere with that?
Sure. What we see with Native American groups is that over time, they come into a new world. They disperse, they spread, they adapt to pretty much just about every nook and cranny in North America, and they settle down. And what happens over time is that populations will grow. They will become less mobile. That is to say, they won't spend all their days, weeks, and years wandering the landscape. And then as the populations grow, and as they interact less with other groups, they begin to develop distinctive identities. And you run that process for 10, 12, maybe 18,000 years, and what you have then is this wonderful mix and diversity of Native American tribes that were here when Columbus arrived. So what we see in 1492 is the outcome, the sort of cultural evolutionary outcome of all of these groups sort of growing and spreading, interacting with one another, certainly to a degree, and developing identities.
What about teeth? What can you learn from that?
There's been a lot of effort in probably the last 20 or so years to identify population histories based on both teeth as well as bones. It's a little more complicated for a variety of reasons. In the case of teeth, they change very, very slowly, and so dental patterns may not track changes over time as well as, say, genetic patterns might. Bones, and especially one sees a lot of use of the shape of the skull, the size of the skull, that's problematic because these things may change too quickly. That is to say, they may change for reasons that have nothing to do with who one's ancestor is, and one doesn't want to get too far into a discussion of race because it's largely a cultural construct, not a biological reality, but you can't really use skulls in any unequivocal way, and certainly in any uncontroversial way, to identify groups, because oftentimes shape and size can be a function of nutrition, it can be a function of growth and development history, it can be a function of environment.
I remember when we met, it was almost 10 years ago, on a dig in the Oklahoma Panhandle, and I asked you about the Kennewick man, because that was very controversial at the time. Tell us the story of that, if you would.
Well, to a degree, it is still controversial.
Uh-huh.
That was a discovery that was made in the state of Washington in 1996, and the initial assessment of the skeleton, and particularly the skull, was that this was a Euro-American.
In other words, European extraction.
Exactly.
But old, 8,000 years old.
That's what it turned out to be. And suddenly you've got a European on the banks of the Columbia River 8,000 years ago. And the term that was used to describe this was that it had Caucasoid features. And I put sort of air quotes around the word Caucasoid. It's a fairly, 19th century term. Nobody really uses that term anymore because it doesn't mean anything.
Oid in general means resembles.
Right, right. Well, what happened when the sort of press conference was called and they said there's a Caucasoid here on the banks of the Columbia 8,000 years ago, the assembled reporters, it's hard to say who said what, but somehow the word Caucasian got out. And suddenly we had a European, not just a Europeanoid, right, but a European on the banks of the Columbia 8,000 years ago. That was a very unfortunate statement. Europeans weren't here 8,000 years ago. There's absolutely no evidence that they were, no real scientific hard evidence that they were. Kennewick, it was just, it was an individual. It was a Native American individual. If it looked unusual relative to other Native American crania or skulls of that age, one has to sort of keep in mind what we understand about evolution and evolutionary biology. And one of the things that we understand very, very clearly is that when populations are isolated for periods of time, and mind you, we're talking about 8,000 years ago when there weren't a lot of people here in the New World, and you could have had population groups that were isolated, you have variability. And so the variability that we see in Kennewick is probably easily explained and readily explained by our understanding of evolutionary theory. That is to say, in any population, you're going to have variation. So it was truly, truly unfortunate that it was assigned to a racial category, a meaningless racial category like Caucasoid, at a time when they were still sort of doing the analysis, they hadn't quite finished it. It didn't turn out well for anybody, and it was really unfortunate.
Europeans did attempt to colonize North America about 1,000 years ago. These were people coming from Greenland. They were Norsemen. And it's kind of interesting that whereas Columbus came bearing the weaponry of late 1400s Europe, when the Norsemen came over about the year 1000, their technology was pretty much equivalent to that of the Native Americans.
It's a wonderful story because we understand and we know what happened after 1492, and far less is known about what happened around 1000 AD. And it's a wonderful story because it shows us, for those who still insist on, racial superiority, that old myth, it shows us that, yes, when people are evenly matched technologically, there is no superiority. The Norse came over. They were basically kind of looking around for land. They were armed as sort of 1000 AD medieval people were armed, but they were no match for the natives. They had a really tough time here. In fact, one of the most interesting sort of historic discoveries ever made was a projectile point. A Native American arrowhead was found eroding out of a grave, out of a Norse grave. Clearly, this poor fellow had been shot.
And well, that was in Greenland.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, they took his body back to Greenland and buried him. So the Norse story is really interesting from that vantage. It's also interesting in that what it does is it illustrates for us the fact that not all colonizing attempts are successful, especially when somebody else is home already, especially yes. When somebody else is living there. So the relationships between the Norse and the Native Americans were characterized by sort of very brief episodic contacts. A lot of times it turned out to be violent. They also thought about one another, which is really kind of interesting. There's some Native American carved items that have been found which depict clearly people in Norse dress. They were telling one another about, you know, these strange folks that were showing up. But they showed up a few times and, you know, made a winter camp of it at a place called Lancel Meadows. But basically, they could not gain a toehold here. They could not gain a foothold here and went back to Greenland and Iceland.
Where the Native Americans show up in some of their tales.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, if you read the Norse sagas, they will talk about the Native Americans and they will talk about the fact that we found a land and it was a wonderful land, except, well, somebody else was there and they kicked us out.
When I joined you and some of your students on the dig in Oklahoma, there was someone there who was drilling, taking cores, so that you could see sort of a history of the climate going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And looking out over this broad land, which was not densely populated, people had to be concerned about finding mates for their children. What did people do? We're getting a little bit, well, not necessarily ahead of our story, because this was always a problem so long as North America was sparsely populated.
Folks often use the, you know, somewhat chauvinistic term early man, and I've always thought that was an inappropriate term, not just because it's chauvinistic, but also because early man's not going to get very far without early woman, and they certainly better produce early children, or else they're going to go extinct. And the point you raise is a very good one, especially in context of what we were talking about earlier about people moving fast across a landscape. If you're traveling fast, you don't want to get going too far too fast, because if you kind of outpace the other groups, if you end up going hundreds and hundreds of miles away, when your kids get to be of marriageable age, you're going to have to go find somebody to marry them, right? So you sort of want to keep track, and this is, there's probably a certain amount of pulling and tugging in a colonizing group. There's an incentive, there's an advantage to moving far, to moving fast, to seeing what's over the next hill. On the other hand, if you get too far away, you're going to get into trouble, because obviously you do want to have your kids have their own families and make their own discoveries and move off into their own new worlds.
Now, we've been talking about North America. South America was settled, and the oldest known site is in South America, which means that, presuming that they are related and they came in from Alaska, they had to travel all the way down to Chile.
Correct. And that raises the question, why haven't we found evidence as old or older here in North America, presuming they passed through on their way south?
Perhaps you can describe Monteverde first.
Oh, okay, sure. The site that you're referring to is in southern Chile. It's called Monteverde. It's on the banks of Chinchihuapi Creek, which is a tributary of the Maullín River. And excavations there in the late 1970s into the 1980s by a good friend and colleague of mine, Tom Dillehay, now at Vanderbilt University, discovered an absolutely wonderfully preserved site in which, for a variety of geological reasons, all the normal organic decay processes basically stopped. And preserved at the site are just this amazing array of materials, including wooden artifacts, chunks of mastodon meat, tied string. There's even a few wads of chewed up leaves that somebody had chewed and spit out on the ground. And the site dates to about 12,500 years ago. We don't have in North America anything that we've clearly and generally and universally agreed is that old. On the other hand, there are some fairly compelling sites that we suspect are probably as old. And there's one fairly newly discovered site out of South Central Oregon that is at the moment being worked up, that looks to have good evidence of people in that part of the world around 12,400 years ago. So we're starting to get there, but it's still an interesting question as to why the oldest sites in the New World are about as far from Siberia as you can get.
What was the landscape like when these people came over? And as you mentioned, it's a changing ecology. If they're going from the coast over the mountains into the Great Basin, it's always changing. What were they seeing as they came in through Beringia? They made it over the steppe, in other words, the grassland. What did they meet up with? What kind of animals were they going for? What kind of plants?
When people arrived, the great majority of the Pleistocene mammals that are now extinct, well, it depends on when they arrived as to whether it was a great majority or not, because we're not exactly sure when. There's 36 genera of large mammals and some smaller mammals that go extinct at the end of the Ice Age. Many of them lasted up until around 10,800, 11,000 years ago. So a number of them were here when Clovis people, for example, were wandering around the landscape 11,000 years ago. Certainly they were here when the ancestral Monteverdians passed through. Some of these animals would have been familiar to folks who'd come over from Siberia. So they, or rather their ancestors, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, they would have seen mammoths. They would have seen giant bison. They probably would have seen horses. But as they got further south, those first Americans were encountering some very, very different kinds of animals and almost certainly different kinds of plants, because they're coming from Siberia. And when you come from Siberia and then you end up in the deciduous forests of eastern North America, it's a whole new ballgame.
How so?
You're dealing with plants that can produce all manner of nuts, fruiting plants, that kind of thing. And you've got to figure out, okay, well, which ones of these things are edible? I mean, imagine the first time you encounter, poison ivy. Imagine the first time you hear that very distinctive sound of a rattlesnake. When you came from Siberia, there wasn't poison ivy and there weren't rattlesnakes. So you've got to figure out, okay, well, what's going on here? What is that really strange noise that I hear? Is this snake just saying hello? People had to learn. They had to learn their landscape. And that was one of the challenges, in fact, of being here first, is that there wasn't anybody to ask.
And if that snake is just saying hello, it's potential food.
Exactly. And, well, here in Texas, people do eat rattlesnakes.
It does taste like chicken.
That's what they tell me.
These people came over well before 10,000 years ago. It was only about 10,000 years ago that people started settling down, that they invented agriculture, both in the Old World and the New World. It was about that time that people began domesticating animals. And with the domestication of animals came diseases, measles, smallpox, all sorts of diseases. In the Old World, many people must have died from these diseases, but eventually the population evolved to be resistant. That never happened in the New World, with really dreadful results.
That's absolutely true, and in fact, the end coda of the whole peopling of the Americas process was that by virtue of the fact that Native Americans, ancestral Native Americans, left the Old World when they did, by virtue of the fact that they came to a new world in which large game animals were readily available without having to corral them and raise them, I mean, think of bison on the high plains, by virtue of the fact that they stayed isolated from their Old World distant relatives, they were essentially previously unexposed to any kind of diseases that had evolved in the Old World, and the primary killer among them is smallpox. So when Europeans arrived, and it wasn't until 1519 or so when Cortes in the Valley of Mexico had, it's a long complicated story, but basically one of the troops that was with Cortes was carrying smallpox. And smallpox jumped to the native population, a native population that had absolutely no immunity. It hadn't lived with smallpox for 2,000 or 3,000 years, and so it hadn't really developed any kind of resistance to what in the Old World was by then a childhood disease. And the consequences were devastating. Native Americans died in horrific numbers. Estimates range from 75% to 95%. But populations have begun to rebound in the last century or so. But for several centuries, immediately after contact, these European-introduced diseases were a scourge of Native American populations with absolutely tragic consequences.
Thomas Jefferson instructed Lewis and Clark to take smallpox vaccine with them and teach the natives how to use it, but by that time it was too late.
Yeah, Jefferson was very carefully tracking Edward Jenner's experiments, and he knew the vulnerability of Native American groups to introduce infectious disease, and he was very keen for Lewis and Clark to do what they could. But as you say, you know, this is early 1800s. They didn't have the kind of healthcare abilities that we have now, or that we're arguing about right now in the modern political system.
Dave, what are you working on now?
One of the things that we've been always curious about is we know that these people were mobile. We know something about the kinds of plants and animals that they used. We know something about the distances that they traveled across the landscape. One of the things that we don't know a lot about is what happened come wintertime. You don't, even if you're a mobile hunter-gatherer, you don't spend your winters slogging around the snows of the Rocky Mountains or the Great Plains. Presumably you hunker down. We've recently begun work with a group at Western State College in Gunnison, Colorado. We've joined forces with them. We are working on a Folsom Age winter, what appears to be a Folsom Age winter camp. And it's really quite exciting because there appear to be a whole series of structures that were occupied simultaneously by a group. And if all of this pans out, if all of this turns out to be what we think it is, it will give us our first real good glimpse into what a winter camp looked like for people who lived at the tail end of the Ice Age.
Dave, I enjoyed your book immensely. I recommend it to just about everybody. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for calling. I've enjoyed talking with you.
I've been speaking with Professor David Meltzer. He is professor of prehistory at Southern Methodist University and author of First Peoples in a New World, Colonizing Ice Age America. It's published by the University of California Press. I'm Al Stoller.